The construction sector was placed in ICU during COVID-19 following years in high care since the 2010 World Cup. Issues over local procurement, construction mafia, cartel accusations and a stagnant economy. It's been a slow drip poison for the once mighty sector. And that's why President Cyril Ramaphosa's long-awaited inaugural Sustainable Infrastructure Development Symposium of South Africa is so eagerly awaited, when government will lay out its long-term pipeline of priority projects for construction and infrastructure development companies, and it's part of government's plan to provide visibility and understanding of where infrastructure investment is being made and by whom, to boost market confidence and help the infrastructure sector with planning. It's being touted also as a platform to explore partnerships between the public and private sector. And to say this comes at a critical juncture and much of the president's economic hopes rest on it wouldn't be an understatement. To preview the Sustainable Infrastructure Development Symposium, let's welcome our panelists. Dr. Josienzo Ramakgopa, head of the Investment and Infrastructure Office inside the presidency. Andres van Heerden, CEO of JSE Listed Building Material and Mining Business Afrimat, and we've also got Chris Campbell, who is head of the South African, or the Consulting Engineers of South Africa, I should say. Chris, welcome, and Dr. Ramakgopa too. Let's kick off with you. What is the main aim of the Sustainable Infrastructure Symposium?
Well, thank you very much for the invite. Well, essentially, is to try and stimulate demand. So it's a conversation that emanated in December of 2019, the president could almost see that the signals were there. We were confronted with the significant adverse economic headwinds. The fiscal headspace was diminishing. Unemployment was rampant. So his view was that an aggressive build program can help us to ensure that we drive demand, and with that, we can resuscitate the supply side and ensure that on the back of that, you industrialize, broaden the manufacturing base of the country, and then absorb the skills on the supply side or lack of skills on the supply side. We then began a process of engaging with the private sector, because we came to acknowledge that the state's capacity in relation to project preparation, particularly technical and financial engineering skills, have been decimated. So we had to look outside the state to engage with private sector, and we found that private sector was more than willing, because private sector also thrives on the existence of a credible and robust project pipeline. They were able to commit to committing resources, and indeed on the meeting that took place on the 18th of Feb, chaired by the president, we had country heads of the MDB, CEOs of both the DFIs and the commercial banks and the construction-oriented organized bodies like CISA. They all committed to that process. And then we began to mine projects within what we call the network industry, water, energy, transportation, ICT infrastructure. We also added agriculture and human settlements. And guess what? Five months later, we've been able to get a significant proportion of those projects to closer to financial close. We have packaged those projects, presented them to a pitching session attended by over 60 financing institutions from across the globe. We had over 210 participants, did the project prospectus of the projects, all the projects that we have pitched. They have demonstrated commitment, and come the 23rd of June, we hope that we are going to cement that, and in a way, we are beginning to galvanize the supply side industry and the economy, and this will anchor our recovery effort going into the future.
Very exciting to see what can be achieved if we see the public and private sectors working together to scope these projects, bring them to bankable feasibility, which is what we've been lacking in the past. We've spoken, Dr. Ramakgopa, in the past at length about using infrastructure as this catalyst. What's been different this time around?
Multiple things have been different. The first one is government's admission that on our own we'll not be able to achieve this, and saying that the quickest way of getting that project preparation capacity is the effort to engage with the private sector. And the private sector also admitted that for them to be able to, for the country to have a credible project pipeline, there has to be convergence. And now suddenly, private and public sector are all at the same table trying to engineer a project pipeline for the country. The second part is that we are co-sponsoring some of the legislative reforms that needs to be put in place to ensure that indeed we are accelerating the build program, because many of these is undermined by regulatory processes. Government is inagile in some instances, unresponsive, and it's cumbersome, the kind of requirements that are needed. So all of us are now beginning to co-sponsor, so there's convergence on what needs to happen. The third part is that we don't necessarily have to rely on the fiscus. Like I said, what COVID has done and the downgrade is to decimate the fiscal headspace. So we need to package projects and prepare them so that they lend themselves to commercial participation by the commercial players. And then the fourth part is that now we're going to operationalize the infrastructure fund. Remember, the president had announced 100 billion rands of infrastructure fund, which essentially is a blended financing mechanism. So essentially what the public sector says, we are prepared to de-risk the project by taking the first loss, and in that way we are going to crowd in private sector participation. So those are the, for me, if you like, the defining characteristics of this process, and we are beginning to institutionalize it going into the future. I mean, just an admission on our part, private sector, public sector, we need to sit around the table and ensure that we advance common interests that are to the advantage of the country.
Those are some pretty significant changes from the past. Chris, to bring you in here, many of the country's top construction firms have been decimated over the last 10 years. We've had very high profile business rescues, delistings, and quite clearly capacity constraints exist. Do we have the ability to scale up sufficiently to meet projects of this nature as they come on stream? Where do you see the potential challenges or bottlenecks to achieve this?
So, thanks, Michael. Look, I think from a construction sector perspective, firstly, I think we need to be clear. What we're seeing is actually a bit of a global phenomenon. Big construction companies worldwide. You've seen it in the UK, Carillion. You've seen it in Brazil. Have likewise been decimated for various reasons. So what the challenge may be for us as South Africans is to try, at least locally, is to try and create that safety net for those companies who are just about hanging on a thread, and then make space for the growth and development of a new set, for the next generation of companies with their own credibility and so on to be able to get into this space. But I think coupled to that, Michael, over and above just the construction companies itself, we have a challenge at the same time of a really aging professional cadre. When I look at the registration stats of and I'm going to talk broadly of engineering practitioners, where I include engineers, technicians, and technologists. Your latest EXA stats show that, of the 19,000-odd practitioners registered as professionals, if you did a filter on that and you looked at 60 years and older, you're sitting at 50%. So that's a massive challenge in terms of how do we've got to find a way of using that skills and knowledge base to help mentor our next generation of practitioners. Because people are going to move on in their lives and so forth. Mm. So certainly that could be a limiting factor if we don't apply a combination of factors to just simply construction. We've got to look at the future generations, the mentoring, the upskilling, and so forth, and use those large numbers that may ride off into the sunset eventually, but use their knowledge and their skills to create our next generation.
But if you're stimulating aggregate demand, as the government is trying to do, as Dr. Ramakopa has said, that helps to stimulate the supply side as well and starts focusing and concentrating energy on creating the requisite skills. These are long-term projects, and Andries van Heerden, we know infrastructure are big capital intensive, long lead time projects. From your vantage point at Afrimat, what are the necessary preconditions that will see private sector capital flowing into big infrastructure projects in this country?
Yeah, Michael, I think probably the most important is really just that pipeline. We've seen a big contributor to the demise of the industry was a lack of projects in the recent past. And if, you know, if we from a private sector perspective have the confidence that the project pipeline will be there, you know, getting investment and even getting skills is not the biggest problem. You know, if we have a consistent supply of projects and it's within a set of rules and a set of guidelines that we understand and that stays constant, whatever it is, we can plan for that and then we can commit the resources and get it done. But the pipeline is the critical thing. You know, we saw what happened to many of the road builders when SANRAL suddenly disappeared about 2 years ago out of the pipeline, and the effect of that on the industry, you know, is devastating. And that's the critical thing.
So talk to me, Dr. Ramakgopa, a little bit more about the pipeline. I know you can't reveal too much before the 23rd, but what size, what scale are we talking about here? You've mentioned the network industries already. Just give us a sense and a flavor of what those pitch sessions revealed.
Maybe just to make the point that the choice of the network industries was deliberate, because I think they've been proven to have a greater multiplier effect. The second one is that they introduce efficiencies in the economy. I'm talking mobility, I'm talking connectivity, and they're able to provide for production of innovative funding platforms for municipalities in relation to land-based financing mechanisms, because essentially you are opening up corridors, you are able to rezone those corridors, and therefore rates and taxes can be realized from there, and then you reinvest it back into the economy. And depending on how you want to, you are going to design them, they can be designed in a manner that they are labor intensive and therefore absorb the supply side, and in the short term be able to address the skills question. But they also help you with regards to, I mean, if you have to have designation with regards to input materials, so you are able to revitalize the economies of various spaces, townships, villages, and small dorpies. So essentially, it's in the design of this project. So I'm just saying the choice was deliberate. So we're talking in some instances around the provision of what we call the Rural Bridges Program. I'm sure you see there's documented experiences of people in the far-flung areas, rural areas. Kids can access schooling. People can access social services after a torrential rain because the rivers are overflowing. Mm. So essentially you're providing them access to ensure that they get to schooling and services that are required. We're working with SANRAL, one of the biggest programs that will be announced, and Andres and Chris, I think, have mentioned this, is that over a period of, I think, the past 24 months, SANRAL was inactive, to the scale that we have come to understand SANRAL. So I think it's one of the biggest beneficiaries out of this intervention. So you'll see that we'll be announcing a massive program, and SANRAL will be at the center of delivering that. So essentially, I mean, it's about allowing for mobility and efficiency in the network. And then there's work that we are doing with regards to the small harbors, and I think it's a 1.6 billion intervention there. There's work that we are doing with the Transnet. A significant amount is sitting there with the Transnet efficiencies at the ports to allow us to access markets beyond the domestic market. And the point we are making is that there's a relationship on how road-based freight transport is connected to efficiency of the ports, so that you, in the quickest possible way, you are able to access foreign markets. And I think it gives you a competitive advantage in that sense. And then the third area, which is an albatross really, is the collapse of municipal water infrastructure. So I'm talking about the water treatment plants and the wastewater treatment works. And I mean, part of the problems that have been exposed by COVID is the fact that about 6,000 or so schools don't have potable clean running water.
Yeah.
So that's a problem that is confronting us. So you are going to find that we are investing a lot of money in water, but we are not looking at it as individual projects. We are seeing it as a program approach, if you like. So there are municipalities, you know, municipalities are the ones that are responsible for that infrastructure. Some of these municipalities are dysfunctional. They are illiquid. Some of them are insolvent. So they don't have the sufficient balance sheet to support the kind of infrastructure that is required. So we're saying that instead of penalizing the users there, develop a national program that is going to make an intervention across. And in that way, you are able to provide the transversal function. You are going to aggregate and ensure that in the shortest possible time, you deliver that those interventions.
On that point, Dr. Ramakopa, you mentioned the fact that all of these big projects dovetail with network industries that have been obviously aligned through the Treasury document as well, which identified network industries as absolutely critical, but also the funding mechanism will have to be taken away, for example, on the water space from municipalities to a national level. And we know that some of the old models of doing things on balance sheets by state-owned enterprises just simply won't work anymore. So what are some of the new models that you're being that you have been exploring over the last few months?
No, I think it's a valid point. I think the risk is also on the funding side. Let me just give one or two examples. The first one is with regards to the fiscal framework. So the fiscal framework allows for the medium-term expenditure framework. So typically, you find that, just giving hypothetically, a roads project, 100 kilometers of road, is funded over a period of 3 years. And let's assume that you are spending 100 million for that. So they say we give you 33 million for the first financial year, 33 million for the second financial year, and then we are going to give you, if you like, 34 million for the third financial year. But Andries and Chris can tell you that in some instances, industry has got capacity to build that 100 kilometers of road in one single financial year. But you must wait for 3 financial years for you to be allocated that. So what are we saying? We are proposing that you can front load. Because essentially in the fiscal framework, the MTF provides for, if you like, a guarantee. So you know that the money is coming. So front load it, allow Andries, Chris, and their constituencies to build that road in the shortest period of time. But in terms of the funding dispensation, it gets to be funded over a three-year financial period. And then you go to the MDBs and say, please fund, give us this 100 million rand today. Yeah, so that the contractors can be on site and get to be paid in that period. But we will give you that money over a three financial year. So almost is a form of a guarantee. That's the first part. The second part is the blended financing that I raised earlier on. So we're saying that as the state, we are prepared to take the first loss. So here's a project. It's got the income streams. It's got the cost recovery. But this cost recovery is not sufficient to attract private sector players. We say, no, it's fine. Because you don't believe that this is going to give you the necessary returns. Here's the X billions we're investing in this project, and suddenly the project is bankable. And then the other one is around the PPP dispensation. If you look at the RIP program, I'm sure Andries and Chris will tell you, it's an exemplary program on how it can be achieved in the shortest possible space of time. I mean, the Treasury approval one, and to until Treasury approval 3. So these are the steps that you need to follow for you to conclude a PPP. It's not uncommon to find PPPs being closed over a period of 12 years. So we say truncate that process. And part of the problem sits with the state because we don't have the technical and engineering and financial engineering capacity to package projects in a manner that they are attractive to private sector. Yeah. And that's why it takes an inordinate amount of time. And that's why we have roped in private sector that at the design stages of the PPP, please be at the table, because through the lenses of an investor, you are able to critique the model and say, advise us on how best it can be designed. And the last ones is on the build operate transfers, especially with regards to social infrastructure. What is coming to us now is that as part of our preparation for NHI, we need to roll out the public healthcare capacity. In fact, improve the ratio of population to bed. So essentially, you need to build hospitals. But remember, health says, look, over the financial years, I'm guaranteed X billions of rents coming to me for infrastructure. Can I commit this to someone like Andries and Chris, package a solution build these hospitals for me, and then I will pay you this amount of money. I'm guaranteed this amount of money from the fiscus, but I can't pay you at the go. I'll pay you over a period of, say, 15, 17 years, whatever the model says. And then you build, you operate it. At the conclusion of that agreed time period, give us the asset back. But again, this is not a new innovation. It's about the state and private sector working together and designing an acceptable model on how you want to address this. So that's absolutely. Those are some of the examples, yes.
Dr. Ramakopa, I think one of the keys to unlocking this now, we've got the mechanisms, we've seen it work in the REAP program, is perhaps ensuring that there is sufficient confidence and trust between the two partners to work together. Andres, do you think we've done enough to overcome some of those regulatory and ideological issues for the private sector to go and work with the government in this way?
Michael, I think there's still some way to go. I think we've seen a lot of improvement, and I think just the fact that Dr. Ramakopa is there is already a very, very strong step in the right direction. It gives a lot of confidence in where we're going. But I think in terms of the regulatory environment, there's still a lot of work to be done, especially around the PPPs and exactly how it works and the processes of that. And then later on in the detail of the administration, making sure that the contractors get paid on time, those things, the old problems, that it's not necessarily, big problems, or it is big in a sense that if you don't get paid, you go bankrupt. But those issues are still there. And I think we still need to address them and get them going. And I think we've made a big step forward with what Dr. Ramakopa said earlier, the government or the authorities understanding that there are certain limitations in terms of capacity and things like that. And if we can find a way where, on the one hand, the private sector can be more involved and help, but on the other hand, just make sure that we don't get corruption creeping in again and all that. I think that's the formula where we can have an honest cooperation between the two parties and work towards a better future. That's where we go. But to get back to your question, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely.
To get there.
Chris, what's your perspective on it, and specifically when we see issues like local procurement, which were perhaps published with the noblest of intent, 30% local procurement, then turned into construction mafias blossoming around the country? Have we done sufficient work to ensure that if these projects are scoped and awarded on tender, that we don't go back to those same old problems of projects being stopped because of construction mafia?
So, Michael, I think what we need to also understand is that much as there is that element, there are other shortcomings in the process. And I have seen entities, for instance, like SANRAL and the member companies working so actively at the design stage with the communities where projects are going to take place so that, A, we're not designing infrastructure for communities, you're designing it with communities. And so you're including those most affected people up front. That then neutralizes the possibility of the unwanted elements trying to abuse that situation. So there's been a lot of that. And so, to Andres's point, I certainly agree with the regulatory frameworks. Dr. Ramakopa is fully aware of it, is we've got to put more efficiency. We can't bypass very good legislation like making sure our environment is protected. We've got spatial planning issues, but those and water use licensing, those should be done as efficiently as possible as well. Otherwise, you don't only have the medium-term expenditure framework creating blockages, you have these permitting systems that create the invidious situation because you run then into legislation, you get to year three, everybody's scared to make a decision to go further because we've got a very good processes and systems, but there are unintended consequences.
Yep.
So if an SOE like SANRAL gets to year three, the road's not quite finished, it's not up to the bridge yet, dare they finish it? No. Because there's a fear of the legislation around the audit.
Chris, I've got to interrupt you there. We've got a minute to go. Dr. Ramakorpa, it's the age of COVID-19. Conference centres were only opened yesterday by the president. We're still waiting to see the regulations. How is this symposium going to be conducted? All digital?
All digital. Well, it's a hybrid model. The presidential roundtable will have about 7 participants or so with the necessary social distances, and essentially the heads of the MDBs, the World Bank, NDB, also including the DBSA in the room with the president, organized business in the form of BUSA and BBC, just having a conversation and instantaneous analysis of where infrastructure is at, the kind of interventions that are required. And all the participants are going to be virtual in the respective sectoral ministerial roundtables. Yes, I think this is the new normal going into the future. It's a hybrid model, but a significant proportion of it is digital. Yeah.
Very exciting, and can't wait to see some of those projects on Tuesday, and a lot of transparency in a process so far that has been shrouded, if you're not at the coalface, in a little bit of secrecy, but it certainly sounds like we are heading in the right direction. Dr. Josienzo Ramakorpa, Head of the Investment and Infrastructure Office inside the Presidency. Andres van Heerden, CEO of Afrimat, and we also had Chris Campbell, CEO of Consulting Engineers of South Africa. All eyes on next Tuesday.